This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Are trees feasting on the carbon humans are adding to the atmosphere? Earth Week continues with an eco-focused gardening show. We'll talk about the impact excess carbon is having on forest growth, get expert advice on native plants and pollinator gardens, and, of course, we'll take your questions. Joining me now are Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator, Kamisha Montgomery. Welcome back, Kamisha.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO, John Butcher. Thanks for being here, John.
Hi, Lucy.
And Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation, Corey Christopher. Welcome back, Corey.
Thanks for having me back.
Cincinnati Nature Center is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. And let me tell you some really exciting news, all you gardening super fans out there. Back by popular demand, this summer, we're going to have two gardening shows a month from May through August, every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. So we will be here for you to answer your questions. Give us a call right now, 513-419-7100, or email talk@wvxu.org. So, John, you sent me this write-up from Ohio State, I should say the Ohio State University, with this headline, "Climate Change is Turning the Trees into Gluttons." What is happening here?
Well, carbon dioxide, the trees take and recycle and put oxygen back out for us, and with a surplus of carbon dioxide, the trees have more food, if you will, to grow. And so there's this theory in the article that maybe the trees are growing taller and getting bigger than they were in the past because of excessive CO2 levels. And I don't, like, I'm not the expert on this, that I didn't do the research, but it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like just going to a buffet, all you can eat carbon dioxide for these trees.
That's right.
Yeah. And this is important for people too, right? Talk about, I mean, trees are helpful for humans. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think the really cool thing is that if this is actually making the trees grow bigger, then they're actually like helping the problem without doing anything different. And my bigger solution for today would be to say, let's plant more trees because if that's happening and they're fighting for us, couldn't be a better way to slow down the warming of the planet, in my opinion.
Yeah. Should this change the way people care for their trees, too? I mean, when they're thinking about, you know, trees they already have?
I don't know that it would change the way they care for them. It's not a change that we've seen, but there's lots of weird things happening lately with a lot more bugs on plants than we've seen in the past. But I think a lot of that's just cyclical anyway and maybe not always attributed to climate change.
Okay. Well, Kamisha, I want to talk about soil health, too, because I didn't realize soil can also help store a lot of carbon if you farm it and use it properly. What are some of the most eco-friendly strategies for gardeners to improve their soil health?
Well, first is getting started early. Don't wait until it's time for you to put your plants or sow your seeds. So that means preparing your soil the prior season. So you can start by applying a cover crop, which is going to help put more nutrients back into your soil. But if you are waiting until a few weeks, you know, around this time before you plant your warm weather crops, you can always add aged manure and compost into your soil to make it a little bit more nutrient dense for your new plants.
Do you need to get a soil test before you decide what to do to your soil?
It's not necessary unless you see some deficiencies in your plants from previous years. But as far as like crop rotating, that's another good way to make sure that you are getting enough nutrients for your plants. But it is, if you do recognize that you've had some deficiencies in your plants, then yeah, go ahead and get a soil test. Or if you plan on having something new to plant in your garden, then a soil test is recommended. And you can get one of those from either Ohio State, Hamilton County Conservation, or our Kenton County Extension Office.
Okay. Corey, are old school techniques the best when it comes to soil health? What do you like to do?
You know, I still use that old, and Kamisha, you're going to know more than I am. I still use that old trick where you're trying to figure out how much clay your soil has. And if you get a handful of dirt out of the, it's soil, I know it's soil. If you get a handful of soil out of the ground and you sort of ball it up, if it sticks together and stays together, you've probably got a lot of clay in there. So from my perspective, when you get a handful of soil and you try to ball it up, it should sort of crumble and fall apart. It's okay to have some clay. You need a little clay, but if you don't have a lot of organic debris in there, or if you can't see anything like, you know, pieces of leaves or straw or whatever, then you might need some soil amendment. So, you know, if you can make a snowball out of your garden soil, you might need to add some compost to it.
Yeah. Yeah, is that, do you agree with that, Commissioner?
I do, definitely. Like you said, you know, there's different ways to sort of test your soil without sending it off. But I agree. If you do not see any organic material or any organic life in your soil, then add some organic material. That will definitely help it out.
Okay. Well, it's our Earth Week Gardening Show, and we have a panel of experts here to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Our very first question of the program comes courtesy of our very talented technical director, Marshall Verbsky. Marshall told me this beautiful story. His ancestors, many, many years ago, this is back in the 1860s, the story goes that they sowed seeds for grapevines into their garments in the 1860s when they came to America from near Prague. I am not going to remember correctly the name of the town, he told me, but they said, he said it was near Prague. He now has grapevine clippings from a plant that has been in the family for generations. He's working very hard to grow them and keep this grape lineage going, but he's worried the spotted lanternfly will destroy his efforts. What can he do to protect his grapevine babies? Kamisha and Corey, do you have any thoughts for Marshall?
You know,
I mean, a family dynasty is resting on this answer, so please,
no
please
pressure.
Answer carefully. That's right.
I think for right now, we're lucky in that we're not seeing a lot of issues with spotted lanternfly. It is here, but I haven't heard of any, you know, major outbreaks or anything like that. That said, there are a lot of techniques for reducing the spread of the lanternfly if you detect them on your grapevines or in your yard. And there's some even green ways of sort of keeping them at bay. There are, neem oil seems to keep coming up when I'm looking at ways of getting rid of them. And even kaolin, it's a kind of clay that you can purchase. It's like a powder that you can put on your plants that will help prevent the lanternfly from breeding. I would just, if it was me, and what I'm trying to do now is just staying in the loop with like USDA, just to see what are they suggesting? What do we know, these organizations that are looking at this every day, are they seeing new outbreaks? What are their suggestions? We're still so early in this that I don't think a lot of people really have a plan for how to respond to this right now.
Kamisha, have you run into spotted lanternfly problems?
I haven't, but given that, you know, when you talked about the kaolin, I would also try diatomaceous earth. Just make sure that you're watching the weather. Make sure that it's not going to rain the next day to just get rid of all of your efforts. And just try to sprinkle some of that on your leaves so that you don't have as much issues with it. Because what that does is basically once the fly would digest it, it will just decimate their insides and you don't really have a problem with them as much anymore. But I would try that out also.
Wow, decimate their insides. That sounds, and that's organic, right? I mean, you're using nature to
it
decimate the insides.
It is crushed limestone, So it is an organic IPM, pest management control.
Wow, we're talking about decimating their insides. And then, Corey, your solution basically is like lantern fly birth control, right?
Sort of the kale. Yes, indeed, it is.
Okay. Well, we've got lots of great suggestions for you, Marshall. I hope that helps. Remember, our experts are here. You don't have to work at Cincinnati Public Radio to get your gardening questions answered. You can call us right now, 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from Lynn. Lynn emails, what native pollinator plants are suitable for a shady garden? And I assume she means shady like not real sunny, not like shady, like sketchy. Yeah. Okay. Kamisha, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. So there are a ton of ones that we put into our garden that you can put into your garden for pollinators. I would suggest a butterfly milkweed. You can get a coneflower or Lazy Susan or or there's others that you'll want to put into your garden to attract those pollinators, and I think those will be a good start. Right now, I would suggest putting in maybe some transplants. In the fall, you can probably put your seeds down, and it depends on the size of your garden also, which route you want to go as far as either transplants or seeds. So a smaller garden, you'll want to you can get away with putting the transplants down, but a larger garden, then I would recommend just broadcasting some seeds.
Okay, and why is that? Because you want more of those little guys all over the place?
And it's easier. it's easier as far as like a larger space. Transplanting a ton of transplants is a little more labor intensive, to whereas just broadcasting them will be easier. It might be less expensive also.
Oh, see, as soon as you said that, I thought that's very wise. That is some wise advice. Corey, what do you think? Are there particular pollinators that you like best for gardens, or do you sprinkle them in there with in your gardens?
Yes, we... Shade natives are tricky because a lot of the shade natives are spring ephemerals, which just aren't readily available. At the Nature Center, we're working really hard to get a number of those available for purchase at our annual plant sales because there's not a lot on the market. We try to organize our plant sales by sun versus shade, so we try to so people can come to the little shade section and get everything that they're looking for, at least by color or size. Some of the ones that I like, though, there's zigzag goldenrod, which I like a lot. I have it in a shade area in my yard. It's doing really well. Coneflowers, I think, are so versatile. They'll pretty much grow anywhere from my experience. Those are probably the top two that I think about. And even Monarda bee balm, even though it likes full sun, I've got some in shadier areas in my yard that are doing just fine. Just trial and error. Give it a whirl.
Yeah. John, I know your business does landscaping in addition to trees. We always think of you as the tree guy, but you're so much more than that, John. Are there pollinating plants that people prefer for their shady gardens? I mean, what's the most popular among the people you all deal with?
I got to agree with Corey that this niche of shade and native is really tough, and they're not plants that are readily available. And I hate to go in and like start recommending like Jack in the Pulpits or these other deep woods things that people might go and poach out of the woods, because they're just not available in garden centers, and they're really hard to find. So a lot of times we may not be doing native in the shade areas, but we're trying to do things that are friendly, and they're still pollinator friendly things that aren't necessarily native.
A new thing I'm doing at home is and I'm trying to get my kids to help me out a little, the violets in my yard before I mow, sort of transplanting those. So going out, digging up some of these little blue violets, because they do perfectly fine in the shade, and they're perennial and they last forever. So even things like that, I think people forget that they're native wildflowers, and we forget that they're important for some of these specialty pollinators too.
Yeah. We are going to continue our gardening show in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our Earth Week gardening show, and our experts are ready to answer your questions. My guests are Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery, Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO John Butcher, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation Corey Christopher. We know you've got questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We got a call from Catherine earlier. She couldn't stay on the line, but she asks, do I need to cut back the plants in my butterfly garden in the fall before it freezes? What do you think, Corey? You look, you're answering with a movement of your head. That doesn't show up on radio very well.
Yeah. No, leave those plants. A lot of insects, including pollinators, will make nests inside some of the hollow stems. And so part of planting native gardens is to benefit not just pollinators or the butterflies, but the things that we may not be seeing, those beneficial insects. So leave your stems. Don't deadhead anything. I think just this past weekend, maybe 2 weeks ago, I started deadheading some of my flowers. So wait until spring. Don't do it in the fall. Give them time to get out of those stems.
That's good. See, that's less work for you, Catherine. That sounds great. We have Kathy's on the line. Hey, Kathy, thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Well, I do have a question and a comment, and I'll start off with the question. I have a mucky gardening site that is just two doors down from a very small creek, and I'm looking for a native grass that might be able to handle all that heavy, muddy sort of soil.
Hmm, that's a good question. Boy, there nobody's making eye contact with me. Who wants to jump in on that one? Corey?
Are you wanting to be able to walk on the grass and mow it, or is this more you want to put a plant there that will do well and not have to worry about it?
The latter. Definitely don't want to worry about it. And I'm planning planting a bald cypress.
Yep.
To sort of also take up that space.
If it was me, I would add a couple button bushes to that around the bald cypress, and then look for, instead of grasses, I would look for some sedges. They look the same, but sedges tend to be much more adapted to living with really wet roots all the time. But between the sedges and the button bush and the cypress, that you should be good to go. That would be my recommendation, like a Pennsylvania sedge, or even some of there's some beautiful sedges, and they have these little blossoms. Don't really look like a flower, but they have these little seed heads that add some sort of interesting texture to the yard too. So that's what I would recommend.
Okay, that's great. And then I just wanted to add to the conversation that I was able to find a native plant for shade areas online, and I can't remember the name of the outlet, but I got some Trillium transplants, some very small ones, from a place in Tennessee. And then they said that goat's beard could take sun and partial shade, so I also planted those.
How's that worked
so
for you?
So far, so good. You know, I think the Trillium is going to take like a while to develop, because they were just the rhizome bulbs, if I'm even using the words correctly. And then for the goat's beard, they sent me some sprigs, and two were surviving, and one kind of got mangled by a squirrel. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, thanks so much for calling, Kathy. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have some more callers waiting. Hey, Dan, thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thanks for taking this. I have a hill in my backyard that's probably about 40 feet long and about 12 feet deep, and it's really hard to mow. And so I just ordered 2,500 lavender seeds, and I'm curious, how would I go about planting that? Do I need to just stick them in the ground and let them germinate, or will that happen, or do I have to start them?
What do you think, John?
Well, I've not done lavender from seeds before, but I do know that they like a little bit of a rockier, more well-drained soil. They like protection, and they like full sun, and they also do really well for a lot of seasons, and then we have a bad winter, and all of a sudden, poof, the whole crop's gone, or down to a really decimated percentage is, you know, of survival is low. And I'd be a little bit hesitant to recommend that large of an area committed to something that's as finicky as it is here. And I know you've bought the seeds and maybe try it in spots, but I might try some other things. They're called no-mow grasses, which do really well on those type of areas, and you may still mow them once a year at the end of the year, but they look like regular lawn grasses that just get a little bit taller and a little bit looser, and you don't have to mow them every week.
Where were no-mow grasses when I had a big yard? Like, I needed this information a few years ago, John, but I appreciate it. Kamisha, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I think John really talked about the lavender, and the, you know, it's a that along with other herbs, you know, once a good frost comes in, it kind of just gets rid of your whole crop. So I would try to think of something that's going to last throughout those temperatures also.
Mm-hmm. I hope that helps, Dan. Thanks so much for calling.
It does. Well, I already bought the seeds, so I'm going to give it a whirl. Can I just sow them, like, just, you know, throw them out there? Or how should I go about
I don't, like I said, I haven't done lavender before, but I think if you just had a nice like really lightly tilled, and I'm not talking about going deep, but scratch the surface enough so that the seed has something to stick to, a lot like grass seed, because if you just put it on the surface, especially on a hill, it's just going to wash right off. And I don't know how steep the hill is, but you may consider something like a straw blanket to keep it held on the hillside, or and even insulated a little bit while they're getting set would be a couple of things that I would say make sense without being a lavender expert.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Dan. We did get an email from Scott. Scott says, one of your guests just stated diatomaceous earth is crushed limestone. Diatomaceous earth is actually made from the fossilized remains of diatoms. Limestone is a sedimentary rock. I don't know if that sounds right to you, Kamisha.
That could be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, Scott. We appreciate your emailing to clear that up. Let's see. We have Scott on the line. Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for calling and for your patience. Do you have a question for us?
Yes. This is the second Scott. great show. I have two very quick questions. In some areas, I've left fall leaves down to allow insects to develop. When can I pick up those leaves?
Good question.
Any day. With the way the weather's been, you could do that this weekend, and it should be just fine.
I will do it next weekend, but yes.
Okay.
The second question is, my wife put in, which means we put in, some native gardens last year. She put down a pine nugget mulch, but then she had second thoughts, and I don't know if she researched it, but it was, she thought it might be more like that finer cypress.
Hmm. So you're trying to figure out what's the best mulch to have in a native garden? Is that what you're trying to figure out, Scott? I think that's what Scott's trying to figure out. Do you have thoughts on that, Corey? Or
yeah, it's good timing because I just did this not too long ago. I use those fall leaves as the mulch for my native flower gardens. So I just take them from one area and put them in another. I use everything from pine straw to regular. I don't fuss too much about what kind of mulch as long as I know there's mulch there, but free mulch falls from the sky every fall, and so that's what I try to take advantage of.
Man, we got some cost-saving recommendations here today. Well, thanks, Scott. I hope that helps. And we have Bill on the line. Bill, thanks for calling. What is your question or comment?
I guess when we had that last burst of 80-degree weather, I planted about six rows of Sharon, and they were sitting out during the winter. I got two of them blooming, and the other ones I don't see anything. Should I hold off before I dig them back up, or do you think they're gone?
There's a really good way to check if they're alive or not, and what you're going to want to do, and do it lower on the plant so that you were, because the base is where life is going to still be available if it's alive at all, and take your thumbnail and just barely scratch the surface of the stem. And if you see green underneath it, and it should be a vibrant green on a rose of Sharon, and it should be really obvious, then there's life left and potential for it to still bloom out. If it's brown and dry and desiccated, you might as well just throw them away now.
Okay. I'm surprised that two of them are blooming even though they were, all of them were out in the cold. I didn't get a chance to get them in the ground till now. But
Rose of Sharon, they're really tough plants. And if you get the self-seeding varieties, you're gonna have all you want soon.
Okay.
Okay.
I just wanted the height for some privacy. I put them in front of the back porch, and some of them they go 8 to 12 feet. So it's going to be a couple years, but
yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Bill. Best of luck with those plants. We have some emails that we can talk about now. Michael emails, we want to transition a neighboring lot from non-native plants and trees to native, but we don't want to lose the cooling shade of the current tree canopy during the transition to native trees. Any suggestion about how to make the transition to native trees without losing the current canopy? Feel like that's you, John.
Sure. So we do this kind of stuff fairly often, and what you're going to do is you're just going to do it in pieces. And obviously, well, I'm assuming there's honeysuckle and understory invasives that are in that you can take out. And you may even do some thinning or cutting back of, I don't know if we're talking about pear trees or ailanthus. When you're saying in non-native trees, I don't really know what we're referring to here. But a lot of our forest understory trees are made to grow in competition and get them started. And then when we get a bigger opening, they take off and go. So I would, you know, get some smaller sugar maples and oak trees and black gums. And, you know, there's 100, I don't know about 100, but there's a lot of really nice native trees that you can get started smaller and just get the honeysuckle out of the way and maybe create a few little pockets of sunlight without taking them all down. And once they get started, then you can start thinking about taking down whole trees.
Okay. But just remember, they're eating up that carbon dioxide. We like our little tree friends for what they're doing for us. Kristen emails, I just read that you can use wood ash from your fire pit to make garden soil more alkaline. Do you recommend this? Do you need a soil analysis first? Kamisha, I'm going to throw that one to you.
I do recommend it. It is a good additive to add to your soil to make it more nutrient dense. I don't think that you need a soil test. It is a great component to add to making compost. So, yeah, go ahead and you can either throw that in your compost creation or system and or just directly into your soil and just try to till that in a little bit.
Okay.
I have a little bit to add here.
Sure.
So I'm not an expert on the vegetable gardens, but I do want to say that in the landscapes, most things that we plant prefer a slightly acidic soil. And so you wouldn't want to use that in your regular beds because raising the pH in Cincinnati soils, which is typically 7 or above, which is slightly alkaline, we don't need to make them more alkaline for most of the things we want to grow.
Okay. Plant acid reflux, I
guess.
That's right.
Exactly.
Okay. Monica emails, what plants are the best to deter deer? Ooh, we have a deer question. I love the deer questions. I have a small garden area and have hostas, iris, and plan to add vincas, New Guinea, impatiens, and geraniums. I've heard marigolds are not a deer's favorite. Anything else you can recommend?
There really are no plants that are going to deter deer from eating something if they're hungry and want to eat it. That's the unfortunate part. There just isn't.
Agreed.
Unfortunately, that's the case. Things like marigolds aren't tasty to deer, so they typically won't eat them, but they don't mind walking on top of the marigolds to get to something that they like more. What we've found is, one, if you don't want to fence the area off, I mean, there's all kinds of deer fencing options out there. So if you don't want to fence the area off, there are some landscaping techniques you can use that make it harder for deer to get to some of those plants that you don't want them to eat. So even things like putting in stones at sort of the front of your bed just to make it more difficult for the deer to physically maneuver their way to the things that you don't want them to eat. Those techniques can be successful, but in terms of plants that you can put in that will deter them, there really just aren't any, unfortunately.
Do you have any other recommendations?
Well, I have a lot of clients that use deer repellent products readily, like all the time, and they're mixing them up and not using the same one all the time. I don't want to endorse a specific product because I think it's about giving the deer something they're not familiar with and makes them uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And once you keep putting the same thing down all the time, they come around anyway. So the big thing I would say is you get a couple of different deer repellent products and mix them up throughout the season.
And we've had a lot of success with that. And if you go to like a reputable nursery, they tend to have those products. We've had a lot of success. After it rains, you have to reapply is the only thing. So don't let the rain wash it away and then the deer come the next day and eat your plants.
I have a radical question. What about cats? Have you seen, cats will fight tigers. Cats will beat on anybody's little head. What if you had a bunch of cats fighting those deer?
Please don't let your cats out.
Now, okay, yeah, that's a good point. All my cats are inside cats, but those cats are tough.
They are.
Okay.
With any horticultural recommendation, it's starting with the right plants and maybe try to work in some things that the deer don't eat as much. And hosta are one of the most notorious. I always say just put out the ranch dressing with it when you plant your hostas.
Definitely. Similar to like trap cropping or companion cropping, try to have a garden over to the side where the deer do like to eat like the hostas instead of the deer just infiltrating to your garden that you're trying to keep.
Oh, so you got to put out a little something for the deer, and then you have what's there for you, and
exactly.
Maybe the deer will stick to their stuff.
They also make sprinkler heads that go off with motion, so you can put those out. I mean, for real, and you just squirt the deer. I don't know if they get, I would assume they get used to it, but.
They get arborist all the time.
And cats, I bet. Okay, well, this is going really well. We will be back in just a moment with today's gardening show. We're going to be wrapping up soon. Now is the time to call 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org. We've got our experts here. We have a tree expert. We have people who can answer vegetable questions, flower questions, any question you come up with. We have the team here to answer. So give us a call, 513-419-7100, or email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our Earth Week Gardening Show. My guests are Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery, Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO John Butcher, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation Corey Christopher. If you have questions about your vegetable garden, landscape, or trees, give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Ron. Thanks so much for your call. Do you have some thoughts to share with us?
Right. And concerns keeping deer out of the garden. We fought them for years and years. We found one thing that helps, and I've got a question about a remark that was made.
Okay.
To keep them out, we simply strung an electrical cord out into the garden. We plugged a radio in, and we plugged a lamp in, and and a motion detector. And when the deer came, the light would go on, and so would the music blare. We changed the channels from time to time, and the neighbors hated us, but so did the deer. So it worked for us. The light plus the music and hard rock seemed to work the best.
Oh, wow. Okay, I was going to ask if you ever tried public radio, but maybe the deer would stick around for that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the question that I have, please, I don't know I'm going to say the word right, surface tint. When I put my pesticides down, I add a surface tint to the water so it doesn't wash away so readily. And it helps. It really does help. Could I also use that with a deer repellent product to the water? It's expensive, the concoction to spray on the hostas and such to keep the deer out.
Yeah, most of the herbicides that you purchase will have a surfactant in it that makes the active ingredient stick to the leaves. Basically, I don't know if some of the buckets of deer repellent that you can purchase tend to be like dry granules instead of sprays. Those don't really have a surfactant because they're just these dry granules. I would think that if you look at the label on any deer repellent sprays you get, I would think they're going to have surfactants in them already, but just read on the back and it should tell you if there's already surfactants in there or not.
But if not, you could probably put in a tiny bit of Dawn or mm-hmm. something like that, which wouldn't throw anything off too bad one way or the other if you thought you wanted to make it stick a little better.
Okay. Hope that helps, Ron. Thanks so much for calling. We have Joseph on the line. Thanks so much for your call, Joseph. What is your question or comment?
I have a mature black walnut tree in my backyard. It was pretty mature when we moved in 40 years ago. It's about 3 feet in diameter, and it's starting to lose some limbs. And I was wondering if there's anything that I could use to amend the soil that can keep this from happening too much farther. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I certainly think that we could do some things to help amend the soil and make the tree healthier. I'm actually, I guess I have a question. Are these live limbs that are breaking or dead limbs?
Dead limbs.
You said dead?
Yes.
Yeah, so aeration is a great way to do this, and not so invasive. We call it vertical mulching in the tree world, and it's where we're basically putting a series of 2 to 3 inch diameter holes in a grid pattern around the root zone of the tree, and we're backfilling with, you could use any, really, you could use leaf compost, you could use anything organic, you could use slow release fertilizers with, we use Turfis on top, which is like a, what they use in baseball mounds to help drainage, and that'll get a little more oxygen to the root system easier and maybe improve the drainage from mowing around it all these years, and it should help it out a little bit.
The base of the tree is covered with a very healthy growth of euonymus.
I would recommend removing that as well. It's not that the euonymus is parasitic, but it's just more competition. And if we're talking about maximizing the performance and health of your tree, the euonymus is not doing it any favors.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for calling,
Good
Joseph.
Suggestions.
Thank you
Thank
so
you.
Much. Mm-hmm. We have Eric on the line. Hi, Eric. Thank you for your call.
Hi. I had a question about compost, and it involves cats also. And I have been separating my when I scoop the litter boxes, I separate the pea clumps from the poop clumps. I use a corn-based litter. There's no clay involved. And I wondered if I can add the pea-based or the pea clumps, excuse me, to my compost, since I think the parasites that cats may have at times usually are in the poop and not the pea. And pea, I guess, is technically sterile when it comes out. And I just wondered if that would be the plant matter in the in the litter would be of any benefit to the compost.
Thanks, Eric. I love this question. Kamisha, do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't know about the parasites with cats, but I do not recommend adding it to a compost that you're going to use on a vegetable garden. Definitely not that. Any kind of feces or anything like that from animals is not suggested.
What about the urine?
I don't suggest adding it to a vegetable garden, although urine does have nitrogen, but not just to a vegetable garden. If you're doing like an ornamental garden, that's something that you can explore. But if you're doing a food garden, I don't recommend it at all.
Yeah. What about cattails? Sorry.
I will say, I think it's, I'm glad you asked this question, because one of the myths in general is that urine is sterile, and it isn't. So you can be potentially adding things to your soil that you don't want to add to it. So you're, Kamisha, you're going to be the compost expert, but
a
little.
Okay.
Yeah. Any of that?
Okay.
Any of the parasites or bacteria?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of that question.
Oh, sorry. Would composting, having it exposed to the heat of the compost pile, would that help alleviate any contaminants in the urine?
Hmm.
Even though the compost is going to heat up to get rid of some unwanted seeds and weeds and different things like that, I wouldn't suggest it. And I don't have enough research or haven't, tested it, but I wouldn't suggest using it on a vegetable garden.
Yeah. So you're saying if you're going to eat it, don't put it in there. If you're going to eat what the garden grows.
Yes.
Well, Eric, thank you. I appreciate you're trying to find a good use for that stuff that your cat produces, because my cats produce that stuff too. And I would love to be able to use it for good and not for evil. But thank you very much. We also have Dick on the line. Hey, Dick, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I have a new landscape company. And when they put the mulch down this year, it was black at first, but when we had those torrential rains, the mulch faded. And I wondered if your team would have a mulch that they would recommend that will stay black.
What do you say, John?
Well, so a lot of the dyed mulches, whether it's black or brown or red or whatever, are susceptible to having that happen. And I really recommend not using the dyed mulches because a lot of times they're just chopped up shipping pallets, and there's not all the other good nutrients in there that we get out of mulch, so you don't have a good carbon to nitrogen ratio. And I would use just a regular natural shredded hardwood mulch, and it turns a deep brown, and it fades out a little bit over the summer, but it'll never lose all of its color. And then you don't have the dye, and you don't have the risk of the dye gets on the driveways, it gets on everybody's clothes, it's a little bit of a mess. And I really recommend avoiding those if at all possible.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for your call, Dick. We appreciate it. Are those kinds of, is that kind of mulch bad for the environment, the dyed shipping container mulch?
You know, I've never looked into what the actual dye is made out of, but I assume they've done the math on that and it's probably not poisonous or anything. Mm-hmm. But there's so many other good mulches to use that it just doesn't seem like a necessary thing to do. And I love the wood chips that are just like fresh products of tree pruning and removal. Those do an amazing job. And actually, the plants perform much better in it, and it repairs a lot of lack of organic matter in clay soils over time, too. So something to consider.
Okay. We got an email from Joan. Joan emails, I cut down our banana trees in the fall to about 6 feet. Did I read that? 6 inches. Sorry. Glasses aren't working. And covered them with stalks and leaves. They now look brown and dried out. How can I tell if they survived the winter? And when should I expect to see new growth? Thank you. Banana tree, anyone?
I don't grow bananas in Cincinnati personally, but I would expect in the next month, if they don't see something coming up, they're probably not going to make it. And I think most people dig them up and take them inside is the normal safe protocol if you want to have them survive. And maybe with enough insulation, they could overwinter. I'm sure that happens, but it wouldn't be reliable.
Yeah. Have you ever tried to grow banana plants, Kamisha?
No. Something like that is more of a more tropical climate plant. So just like you said, digging those out and putting those inside is typically something for a good best practice for something that just loves heat, like a banana tree or a citrus tree or something like that.
Yeah. We got a call from Jim. Jim couldn't stay on the line, but he said he lives on 35 acres and has planted a lot of lavender. The deer don't like it, but he's guessing the deer will just avoid it and he still eat whatever they want. So deer's gonna deer. I guess that's the bottom line there. Corey, let's talk about the best place to buy plants, the best plants to buy. I'm assuming you're going to say native plants are the way to go. Where do you get your native plants?
So you would absolutely think that of me, and for good reason. I do get a lot of my native plants from the Cincinnati Nature Center because we have a native plant program. So we have a lot of selection. But what I've been surprised about, delighted really, in the past probably 4 or 5 years, a lot of places are selling natives now. People are catching on, and I think stores are responding. But I'm not a purist. You know, I also have some exotics in my yard that aren't necessarily native. I suggest that, similar to how people do with taking care of your home, you know, you have the hardware store you go to, and you go to it because the people know what they're talking about if you have questions. Treat a nursery the same way. Go to a nursery that, when you ask questions, that they're responding, they know what they're talking about, they have a good selection, and then stick with it. There are, in terms of native plants, there are a variety of websites and like the posts online where they'll have various posts for all the different native plant sales going on in the area. April is, Native Plant Month in Ohio. And so there's a website for that, too. If you Google that, they'll bring up a whole series of sales of native plants in your area. Mm-hmm. But find a good nursery that you trust and ask them and sort of lean on them as being your garden experts.
Okay. Well, I know there are native plant sales coming up at Cincinnati Nature Center, at Civic Garden Center, at the Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden. We have links to all of that information on our website, wvxu.org. Kamisha, we talked about this a little bit, kind of, but how should we be incorporating pollinator plants in our vegetable gardens?
Oh, yeah. So it's a great way to add more diversity as far as pollinators to your garden. You know, we do want to attract the bees, but we also want to attract the birds and just create another food web in our garden other than our edibles that we're growing to make it more successful. But adding native plants or native pollinators such as coneflowers. I know I mentioned lazy Susans earlier today, that, I mean, which would be pretty cool to have in a garden, but black-eyed Susans and also butterfly bush. You can add them just in areas of the garden, but you can also, like Corey and I discussed, we can also add those in the garden bed as sort of like a companion plant so that you can have those pollinators right next to a plant that flowers. Okay. So those are some good ways to add.
Great. We had Sue called and said the Allwood Audubon Native Plants sale is happening Friday and Saturday near Dayton Airport. So that's another one for our listeners who live a little farther north. We have another caller on the line. Hi, Robert. Thanks for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I was just wondering, for mulch, when's it appropriate to use, like, that pine straw mulch versus other mulch? Or what's the benefit or downside either way?
Okay. Thank you. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, pine straw's fine to use in most mulch applications, but typically we recommend it more on hillsides where people are experiencing a lot of washout because it tends to stick to the hill a little bit better and the water runs through it, where other mulches might just wash out and have big piles at the bottom. But other than that, it can still be used just about anywhere. It's great at lowering the pH in the soil, which is one of the things we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any mulch preferences, Kamisha?
For the pine, I would suggest putting it more towards your, like maybe your berry bushes and trying, because they will like it a little bit more acidic. So I would suggest using it there.
Okay. Hope that helps, Robert. Thanks so much. Wow, we have covered a lot of territory today on our Earth Week gardening show. This has been great. I've been talking with Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery, Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO John Butcher, and Cincinnati Nature Center Director of Conservation Corey Christopher. I know we had some emails that we didn't get to today, but the good news is we're having two gardening shows a month, so stay tuned. Keep with us. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.